Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
On the same steps of the Capitol, where rioters sought to overturn the election 2 weeks ago, President Biden took the oath of office today, pledging unity.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause. The cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people has been heard, and the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
And to talk about this and the significance of this through an historical lens, let's bring in Peniel Joseph. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Peniel, a lot of people are comparing the feelings of this moment to the late 1800s with the Reconstruction and the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, these moments of great change in our country. What moments in our history does today bring to mind for you?
Well, I think we're really actually living through America's third Reconstruction. And in a way, that Reconstruction period started with the election of President Obama and the belief that Obama's election could transform American democracy from the inside out, finally having this first black president. That turned out to be erroneous, and the visions of post-racialism faded with the birther movement, the Tea Party, the rise of Donald Trump. But at the same time, you also had the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of this new movement really led by black women, by black queer radical feminists that really tapped into a tradition that does go back to the first Reconstruction. And when we think about that first Reconstruction, President Biden mentioned Abraham Lincoln in 1863 and saying his whole soul is in it. And he mentioned Lincoln again when he talked about the better angels of our nature. And that first Reconstruction period is really from 1865 all the way to 1896. Sometimes people end it in 1877, but it's a 31-year experiment in American democracy where you have these striking juxtapositions, just like we have today. You've got President Obama and you've got Vice President Kamala Harris. You've got Stacey Abrams, you've got Senator Raphael Warnock, but you've got Proud Boys, and you've got a riot and an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. During Reconstruction, we saw the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which provided voting rights for black men, birthright citizenship, and ended racial slavery except in cases of punishment. All those things were striking juxtapositions because you're going to see during Reconstruction both the rise of a new black political and social and cultural class, but also you're going to see the rise of convict leasing, sharecropping, peonage, black codes, voter suppression, all of which is organized by white violence against black communities throughout the United States. And you see this during the second Reconstruction too. We usually think about the civil rights movement as a period between the Brown desegregation decision on May 17th, 1954, that ends public school segregation, at least legally, all the way up until Dr. King's assassination on April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. But really that second Reconstruction begins in earnest in the 1930s and the 1940s in the wake of the Great Depression, where you see these black women and men who are everything from liberals and Democrats and Republicans to feminists and socialists and trade unionists who are talking about racial justice, a double V campaign, victory over fascism abroad and over racism at home. And the people like Ella Baker and Paul Robeson and Marian Anderson and Mary McLeod Bethune. So when we think about this notion of today, we're really living in the shadow of those first and second Reconstructions that had successes but did not bring about black dignity and citizenship the way they should have.
I want to bring in Jill Lepore. She's a professor of American history at Harvard and also a staff writer at The New Yorker. Jill, you're listening to what Peniel is talking about, saying that this is essentially like the third Reconstruction. In the context of all of this, what does unity mean You know, Biden said that unity was his top priority. What does that look like in the context of what we're talking about?
Oh, I think it's very much something that we will need to invent, that Biden can take some leadership on, but unity is not something that one person can present to a community. I think that the process of reinventing the sort of social contract is what lies ahead of all Americans in the years to come.
Oh, Jill, I wonder if you could talk a little more about that, Robin here, and what you might think of the call from some historians who, you know, when Peniel's been mentioning the Reconstruction, they think we are still in it because it followed, of course, the Civil War and claimed unity, but papered over so many injustices towards blacks for over 100 years. Here's David Blight from Yale. Healing and unity came without justice after the Civil War. That's what's at stake now. There needs to be institutional confrontation. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think, you know, David is the author of an essential work on race and reunion after the Civil War, in which he essentially argued, and I think was entirely right about this, that whites in the North and the South sort of had a kind of tacit and in some ways quite explicit agreement after Reconstruction to reunify the country by kind of agreeing about white supremacy and agreeing to forget what the Civil War was about, agreeing to forget the cause of emancipation and the cause of racial equality and racial justice, deciding to the North, whites in the North deciding to agree with Southerners who espoused the theory of the lost cause that the war was really fought over states' rights. And so there's this profound and deep erasure, both at the level of popular culture and public imaginings and at the level of scholarship itself, you know, with the incredibly important exception of W.E.B. Du Bois, who was swimming upstream of this, of course, so powerfully. American historians participated in that agreement and in that erasure. And I think, you know, David Blight is among those who are calling for a new assessment in this moment that builds on all the scholarship that has been done and the museum work and the school teaching, you know, centuries of work that has tried to bring out the past that has been so whitewashed.
Right. Literally. I mean, you know, an idea of unity, but it has to come with justice at this point when we saw, you know, white supremacists and neo-Nazis storm the Capitol. But Jill, I want to ask you, and Peniel probably wants to weigh in too, but your thoughts about Kamala Harris, you know, first woman of color, first South Asian to be vice president. She wore purple, we're told, in honor of Shirley Chisholm, who ran for president in 1972. Your thoughts?
You know, I got to say, I mean, I'm very curious to hear what Peniel will say about this as well, but watching this afternoon, I watched mostly as a citizen, and I was really just moved by the whole, the majesty of the moment and the symbolism, which I found to be quite powerful. It takes a while for me, I have to say, to pull back from the sense of awe and wonder at this moment, the same sense that I had, certainly, in January of 2009, watching Barack Obama's inauguration, and especially on that day, watching the enthusiasm and excitement of, you know, just the incredible emotion of people who were there that day, who had traveled all night long to watch Obama's inauguration. We didn't have that sense of the audience of people there who had made that pilgrimage to be part of that event. We all, I think, you know, watched remotely on our screens. But I still think felt, you know, very much swept away by that sense of occasion and also a great sense of the gravity of what lies ahead, in the sense that, you know, for all the promise of Obama's election and inauguration, that didn't mark the end of one set of struggles that we continue to face.
Peniel, I want to shift the topic just a little bit in the few minutes that we have. You know, all of this in the backdrop of the pandemic, which has killed more than 400,000 Americans. I mean, Biden has basically said this is a top priority. When we talk about unity, we're also talking about solving this crisis of people dying and stopping this virus from overtaking all of us. Do you think that Biden can rise to the occasion at this point where we've gone through a year where we've kind of really bruised and battered?
Well, absolutely. But I think he's got to amplify the words that he used today at the inauguration. He talked about white supremacy. He's talked about systemic racism. He talked about the violence of anti-blackness in this country. And the COVID-19 pandemic is completely connected to that. Racial justice should be centered when we think about our public policy for health, for education, for criminal justice, but certainly eradicating the pandemic. Already, Black people disproportionately are not receiving the vaccine. And that's not just because of the racist history and legacy and skepticism because of Tuskegee. That's because of structural racism and violence that prevents Black people from having health care and getting health care access. So we can do it. And really, this dovetails into, I was very moved by Kamala Harris, too. But we have to remember, Kamala Harris, she's standing on the shoulders of all these Black feminists and organizers that go back to the 19th century who spoke truth to power. So she's standing on the shoulders of the Fannie Lou Hamers and the Ella Bakers, right? And the Rosa Parks. So we can't just be...
We're going to leave it at that. We thank you so much. Angela Lepore, thank you both so much.